You're listening to The Bike Show on Resonance FM with me, Jack Thurston. This week, the show is coming from Ross-on-Wye, and my guest for a roll around the meandering valley of the River Wye is Edward Pickering, and we're standing at the Prospect by what looks like some kind of beacon that they would have put burning faggots in there to warn the surrounding area of the approaching Armada or something like that in medieval times.
So they're approaching English or they're approaching Welsh? I'm not sure which.
Well, we are on the English side of things here. I've just scooted over from Abergavenny, and you've come down from the southeast, and we're standing beneath the spire of the church here at Ross-on-Wye, which is quite a landmark in the surrounding area. And we're going to be talking about, in a roundabout way, as ever on the bike show, we're going to be talking about a book that Edward's just written called The Race Against Time, and it's about one of the great sporting contests of any sport, I think, and it happened to be in our sport of cycling. This is the contest between Chris Boardman and Graham Obrey in the 1990s to see who was the fastest man on a bike.
Yes, two of our great 90s cycling superstars, Graham Obrey and Chris Boardman, two very, very different characters on the surface, very similar in some other ways, and they were both very, very good at the same thing at the same time, which makes for a great rivalry. They're both excellent at time trial, very specifically British pastime.
And you paint a picture in the book of cycle sport in the 1990s or 1980s, 1990s, when they started out, and it's very different from cycle sport as it is today. And in a sense, that's, I guess, a meta-narrative of your story. It's not just the rivalry between Boardman and O'Brien, but how in 20 years we can observe a real change in the place of cycling in Britain and the way cycling is organised, whether it's training of athletes to the money that's in the sport now. And it's 20 years doesn't feel like it's a lot of perspective, but reading your book, it is actually quite a lot of perspective when you're looking at this subject.
A lot's happened in those 20 years. 20 years ago, cycling was a niche sport in the UK. Now, I would venture to say it's a mainstream sport. And the 1990s were a period of great transition in cycling. It was the moment, well, it started in the late 1980s, but it was the era when technology started taking over and becoming more important in sport. And symbolising all that, you had the career of Chris Boardman, who was very much an analytical scientist on the bike. What he was doing then is by no means unusual now, but at the time it was absolutely revolutionary. And against this you had Graham Obrey, who was very much an intuitive individual, who kind of represented maybe the art against Chris Boardman's science. Even though their methods in some ways were very similar, it was two very contrasting approaches to the sport, and it symbolised the kind of old just being pushed out of cycling by the new, by the science. And of course, because of Chris Boardman's career, because of all that science and the research, British cycling built on his career to become what it is now, which is a major sport in which we have a great deal of success.
Well, we're going to head up, following the course of the River Wye. We're going to be heading upstream. That won't make much difference to us on bicycles, but if we were in canoes, it would be a little harder going. And we're going to do our own little time trial to try and catch lunch at a pub. And round here, the pubs stop doing lunch at about 2 PM. So we've got half an hour to do 8 miles. Do you think that's on? You look the part. I'm not sure that I do.
I think we'll be fine. We've got a downhill start. I don't know if you planned that well, because it does mean we've got an uphill finish. It's not a Cavendish day today.
So we're a few miles out of Ross-on-Wye in the village of Haworthy, We were headed elsewhere, headed a little bit towards Hereford, but I realised that we weren't going to make the 2 o'clock cut-off for lunch. So I moved the goalposts and we selected Haworthy. That's not something that a top-level time trialist is able to do. They're stuck on the particular distances or the times that they're trying to get, aren't they?
Very, very true. We lost our race against time. It's given me an idea for another book, The Race Against Intransigent Kitchen Staff. The member of staff at the pub made it clear he was only doing sandwiches as we're a few minutes past 2 o'clock. But yes, time trialists, the set distances of British time trials, they're carved in stone, aren't they? There's the 10, the 25, the 50 and the 100. Those are the set distances which British time trialists ride.
Why does Britain have this affinity to time trialing? There is the story about the old lady who got run over in the 1890s. But, you know, I don't buy that story. I think there's something else going on that's deeper that made the cycling authorities at the time use that as a pretext to ban this rather tawdry, money-oriented, skullduggerous bunch racing that they had on the continent.
And still do to this day. There's an element of bureaucracy in the British psyche. I'm loath to make too many generalisations, but the bureaucracy and the setting down of information, the recording of information, is all key to time trialing. You know, you have the set distance, you record your time, and it's got to be scrupulously done to the second. So you have the timekeeper, who is a figure not to be messed with under
any circumstances. It's a bit like the scorer in cricket.
Exactly, yes.
Marking every ball in an over.
Exactly, every ball must be marked, every second must be accounted for in time trialing, and that it's attracted a kind of cyclist who's slightly different from the gaudy, colourful, brash road racer. It's the kind of the slightly, I don't want to generalise again, I don't mean this in a to insult or anything, but it's slightly anally retentive, bureaucratic type who wants to kind of record what they can do exactly and then improve it.
And so how did Chris Boardman and Graham O'Bree start riding their bikes? What kind of background in cycling did they have? How did they discover the joys of the bicycle and the pain of the bicycle? Because it was as much about pain as it was about joy.
Yeah, you could argue that Chris Boardman didn't discover the joy of riding bikes until after he'd retired from professional road racing. He came from a cycling family. His father was Keith Boardman, very gifted time trialist, who was, I think, shortlisted for the Tokyo Olympic Games, didn't actually end up going, but obviously a national level cyclist, continued to compete, you know, right through Chris Boardman's career as a veteran. So Chris Boardman was brought up in a family whose main pastime was cycling and time trialing, and Chris Boardman gave it a go. I think he was 13, 14 years old, gave it a go, rode a 10-mile time trial in somewhere between 25 and 30 minutes. I think 28 minutes was his first time, and went for a bag of fish and chips afterwards, and the next week he did exactly the same. He went out with his family, rode a 10-mile time trial, and this is the key. He rode it a minute faster than the week before, and that's what hooked him. He was always addicted to progress and measurement, and from the moment he realised that by working and organising himself he could keep on improving this sport, he was hooked. That's how Chris Boardman got into cycling.
Oh, halfway through our sandwiches, Graham O'Bree liked to eat sandwiches, didn't he?
Legendarily marmalade sandwiches, I think, was his favourite, or jam sandwiches.
What was his route into cycling?
I think for him it was an escape. He's made public in his autobiography that he had a very, very hard upbringing. Wasn't particularly well off. He was an outsider in a small Scottish town where they didn't particularly like outsiders. His father was a policeman, which kind of doubled the reason for him to be unpopular in his town. And he was bullied. Never really felt like he fitted in at school. And cycling was his escape. He realised that beyond the horizon lay another place where he wasn't bullied. So he started going on bike rides, not only to discover what was over the horizon, but to also leave behind what was, you know, on this side of the horizon, which was basically an unhappy upbringing, an unhappy childhood. And he wasn't competitive at it at all. He went on, his routine was touring. He used to go for long touring rides. He'd just go out and explore the countryside. And it was only, I think, he got roped into a time trial and started doing time trials. And he didn't realise how good he was at them, apart from the fact that he would catch people, you know, slow down for a chat and then speed off again, which must have been incredibly irritating for the for the recipient of the treatment, for the victim, but he realised he was good at time trialling, and it was when he beat a former Tour de France pro, Bob Addy, in a time trial in Scotland by a handful of seconds that he realised he was actually quite good and started taking it more seriously. And Graham Obrey being Graham Obrey, when he took it seriously, he did it properly. He started researching aerodynamics and working out aerodynamics and looking at trees to work out which way the wind was blowing so he could work out how the wind would affect his riding. So that was his routine. He started with it being an escape, realised he really enjoyed it, and then started realising that there was a whole world of obsessive behaviour out there. And as he said in his book as well, he's very good at obsessive behaviour.
You had a flirtation with the possibility of being a competitive professional cyclist maybe one day. What was your entree into cycling, and how do you differ from Graham Obrey and Chris Boardman?
Yeah, I'd probably fall halfway, maybe halfway between the two in terms of personality type, which probably makes it may make me quite normal. I'm not sure. My routine, I cycled when I was a kid, like everybody else. But when I was in my early teens, there was a kind of confluence of events that I was very into athletics. I liked long distance running. I was very, very interested in the times that people ran in athletic events, the 800 metres and the 1500 metres especially. I was into athletics. I also, my father was a French teacher and gave me an interest in France, which continues to this day. I loved going on family holidays to France. I enjoyed speaking the language and I loved France. And I came home from school one day in the summer of, I think it was 1984, and there was a clip of the Tour de France on television. I thought, this is amazing. It's like distance running, but it's in France, and it was one of the mountain stages. So these beautiful mountains. I grew up in the West Country of England, where there are hills, but definitely not mountains. And I thought this was the most fantastic, colourful, exciting sporting event held in a beautiful place, which also incorporated elements of endurance and timing and distance, which I thought were fascinating. And I thought, this is great. I bought a bike in 1988, I think it was, and started training. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. It was a couple of sizes too big. But what I did know is that I loved being out in the countryside and I loved riding as hard as I could. So I wanted to be a racing cyclist and I wanted to win the Tour de France. Didn't last long before it became evident that wasn't going to happen. But
why did it become evident?
Well, I didn't have the natural talent. That's at the foundation of everything. You've got to have natural talent.
And what is natural talent?
I suppose it's a combination of large lungs and, you know, these days you talk about, you know, blood efficient, you know, the amount of oxygen your blood can carry, you know, how your muscles work. But really, I wasn't strong enough. But the other thing about cycling is not just natural talent, it's how much work you put in. I think Sean Yates always said that his brother, Christian, was a lot more talented than him and his bike, but Sean had the work ethic. He was able to go out training for 100 kilometres a day or whatever. And I was going to university, I was interested in other things, and I wasn't able to live the kind of single-minded life and have that single-minded attitude to cycling that was absolutely necessary to be a good cyclist. So I enjoyed cycling, but I certainly didn't work that hard at it, and gradually fell away, realised I wasn't going to be a professional cyclist, but still enjoyed it. So that's what I get from cycling to this day, you know, 25 years later, is that, you know, I still love going out, I still love hammering myself, still love going out into the countryside and seeing new landscapes and exploring the landscape and working out the way that road builders built roads to deal with the landscape. If there's a hill in the way, do they go over it, do they go around it? I love all that kind of stuff. I find it fascinating. And a bike ride, you can explore whole new cultures just in the space of a day, you know, whole new regions and areas just on a bike.
Well, let's carry on our exploration of this corner of Herefordshire and get the rest of our sandwiches down us.
Strength, bodies all aching, racked with pain. I took that box, lift that bait. You get a little drunk and you land in jail. I get so weary, sick of trying, tired of living, fear of dying, 'cause old man River, he's
So as well as talent and hard work, single-mindedness, there's a word that's often used in cycling talking about certain riders, and that word's class.
Class, yes, that's
you mentioned
right.
Class, don't you, in talking about Chris Boardman.
I talk about it at length, and though I talk about it, it's one of these things that's indefinable. It's the same with tennis players or cricket. It's the whole package, class, I think. It's a combination of physical ability, mental ability, and grace and smoothness in the technique. So you can say that someone like Bradley Wiggins, you can tell he just exudes class. He's like a thoroughbred horse. When he's riding a bike, he's absolutely beautiful. He's biomechanically efficient. His upper body is totally still. He's like poetry in motion. Chris Boardman also had class. When he rode a bike, he was so efficient. He was able to harness his talent by working hard at it, by taking advantage of his physical talent. And it just meant he looked good on a bike. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at. But the minute you start to try and define class, you realise that there's much more to it than that. And
do classy riders always go fast?
Yeah, I guess that's part of it. Yeah, but it's
can you go fast without being a classy rider?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Graham Obey wasn't a classy rider in terms of he didn't have physical class. He was very much a worker. He kind of bludgeoned his way through, and when he rode, he could dig incredibly deep, but he wasn't like a thoroughbred horse. It was different with him, but it's indefinable. I mean, Obrey's a classy guy. I mean, he's a great guy, but in terms of being a bike rider, he didn't look naturally at home on a bike, on a normal racing bike. And anecdotally, he wasn't so good at riding in a bunch, which obviously one of the things you need to be a classy rider. But you don't want to go too far in defining these things, because then you lose what it is.
I've just climbed that hill in very high gear.
Well,
unable to.
Jack is on the big ring up that climb. That's
unable to change my gears due to holding this microphone. It's just practically killed me. Goodness. Okay. What's that? We've got some polytunnels off to our left. What do you think they're growing?
Don't you? You're the local expert.
I'm wondering. Strawberries?
Strawberries, tomatoes.
Famous for strawberries around here.
Could be strawberries. Herefordshire strawberries.
Oh, yeah. Oh, shifted down. That's good. Who decided to go for the hour record, to resurrect this idea of the hour? Because it's a record that goes back to the very beginning of cycling, and the first holder of the hour record was Henri de Grange, well known as a promoter and the founder of the Tour de France. And it's been set by the greats, Fausto Coppi memorably, Jacques Anquetil, Eddy Merckx. And then it sort of dipped a bit, didn't it, in interest after Eddy Merckx set a record, which I guess did people think no one's going to beat that because that's Eddy Merckx riding in Mexico?
Yeah, Eddy Merckx set the record and broke it. He didn't break it handsomely, but he did do a very good ride, and he destroyed himself doing that ride as well. It was a terrible piece of bike riding. He went off way too fast and did the first 5 kilometres in not much more than 5 minutes. I think it's 5:20 or something, which, try doing that sometime. Most cyclists couldn't even do that, let alone continue for another 55 minutes. And he spent the remainder of the hour basically in an effort of sheer willpower, forcing his body around. Nobody broke it for a decade after that.
Did they attempt it?
I don't think they did. I don't think there was the interest in it. I think that Merckx had been seen as the finest cyclist ever. He had set the hour record, and that was that. Of course, it couldn't last like that forever, because new influences came into sport. The Francesco Moser went for it, who was a rider, a good rider, good road rider, a great road rider even, not in the same class as Merckx. But he had another weapon on his side, which was the science and his doctor, Professor Conconi, who is a very, very advanced in sports science, much more than Merckx was. And so Moser might not have had Merckx's power and class, but he did have science on his side. So he used the weapons at his disposal to set a new record. He had an aerodynamic bike with disc wheels, and this had hardly been seen before. And he set a record, which again was seen as unbreakable, and interest died off a bit after that.
He also had some extra blood in his system, didn't he?
He did. He blood doped, which wasn't a banned practice then. It was kept under wraps. He didn't advertise the fact that, yes, I've got an aerodynamic bike, and by the way, I blood doped. He only confessed this years later, because I think they realised it's not really cricket to blood dope, and the practice was subsequently banned anyway. Once Mose had broken, it was seen as, again, being on the shelf, and nobody went for it because it was seen as such an incredible record. It was only when Boardman, with the benefit of his own sports doctor, Peter Keane, and all the testing they did and all the advancements in aerodynamics, where Peter Keane decided, well, do the training, get it right, pick the right day, and we've got a shout. And so Boardman announced that he was going to go for the hour record in 1993 first, even though Obi says that he decided at the start of the year he's going to go for it, but only announced it after Boardman.
Who do you believe?
I tend to believe Obi probably did tell a few people he was going to go for the hour record, but Obi's a very energetic individual, and he's always got lots of ideas, and when he has an idea, he wants to follow it to his logical conclusion. He has lots of ideas, and I'm sure he did have the idea, at the start of the year and started training for it, because he couldn't have had the idea in May and become ready by July to break it. So he must have been training for it for some time before then, which means he probably did decide before Boardman to go for it, but Boardman only announced it later.
And so this is the story, really, of two British time trialists, admittedly very good and also good on the track, who were essentially taking on a new level of endeavour with the hour, because this time the Olympics was separate from professional sport, wasn't it? Because the Olympics was for amateurs.
Yep.
There was a whole other world of professional cycle sport. But the hour is a totemic event for the history of cycle sport. And so they're essentially putting down a marker saying, we are world class. We might not be riding in the Tour de France or whatever, but we are world class. Look at us. And from what I understand reading your book, there was quite a clever plan from Chris Boardman to do it in Bordeaux at the time when the Tour de France was coming through Bordeaux, and all the journalists would be there, and that would set him up really well for a professional contract, which is the next future development of his career.
Yeah, exactly. The hour record is totemic. It's a comparison across the ages. It's the measure by which we can compare cyclists from different eras. Jacques Anquetil and Eddy Merckx could never race each other at their peak in the Tour de France. But with the hour record, they could race each other. Merckx could take on Anquetil's finest performance and do an exact comparison. Even though, obviously, with technology, training, the fact that you went to Mexico to altitude to do it meant that it wasn't exactly a level playing field. It's the best we've got. And historically, especially since the era of Coppi, it's a track record, but it's the finest road riders of each generation who have broken it. So through Coppi, Anquetil and Merckx, and even Moser, they were established great stars of international road racing who put themselves on a pedestal by doing the hour record. Boardman and Obrey came from nowhere. Obrey was, I think he might even have been a third category road racer. He was not an international cyclist. He came from a different angle, and so did Boardman. Boardman did it in reverse. Most riders established a great road career and then did the hour record as the crowning glory. Boardman used it as a conduit to become a professional cyclist. That was very much him and Peter Keane, his doctor's, his trainer's way of thinking. They always tried to follow a logical plan, and their plan was that Boardman could become an international road racing star. But Boardman had a young family. He was either 19 or 20 when he had his first child, and went on. He's got six now. So with a young family, he just didn't see it as feasible to go over to Europe and start from square one and kind of work his way up.
The traditional route here is that you get sent over in a beat-up old second-hand car with 200 quid in your pocket and kipping on somebody's floor, trying to get an opening with a low-level team and work your way up. And that's a well-trodden path. I guess it's a path that's perhaps becoming less well-trodden. Now we've got centres of excellence and all the rest of it and academies of cycling for the youngsters. But that wasn't an option for Boardman. So he had to think of another way around that problem, right?
He did. He invented a new way for a British cyclist, for any cyclist actually, to become a professional. He didn't want to work his way up. He wanted to go in at the top floor. So they worked out a way to do that. And it was the great publicity coup of his career.
But he didn't realise that he was not going to be breaking Francesco Moser's record.
No, he was a bit disappointed at that. And there was a bit of some comments in the press between the two. And I think Boardman was a bit disappointed at that. Because even though Boardman's a very pragmatic character, he's not that... He doesn't have an idealistic view of cycling. But I think I think he was disappointed that the 9-year-old hour record, which had been seen as unbeatable, he wasn't actually breaking that. He was breaking the hour record set by a third category roadman from Scotland, who no one had heard of. And I think that took the sheen off it a little bit for him. But in a way, he was lucky that Obrey broke the record before him, because Obrey suddenly reignited interest in the hour record, which everyone had forgotten about. Suddenly, the first few pages of L'Equipe were covering the hour record. And this was just a few days before Chris Boardman's own attempt. It was, in a way, it was perfect for Boardman that people were talking about the hour record all week in the run-up to his attempt. So although it might have been disappointing not to break Moser's hour record, it certainly helped on a publicity front.
I want to ask you a couple of questions. One about Obrey and his extraordinary bikes, because that became the story for him, didn't it, really? He went fast not only by being a strong, well-trained rider who was able to bury himself, but because he had an amazingly innovative approach to his position on the bike and the design of the bike itself.
Exactly. Obrey had an intuitive understanding of aerodynamics, and he had a way of being able to take a step back and look at the way things are done, and not just try and do things better, but try and do things differently. So he went right back to basics with his bike. He took a look at his position on the bike and tried to see it as if it was the first time he'd ever seen a cycling position. He realised two things which to his mind were crucial. First of all, that if he took his arms out of the equation, there would be so much less aerodynamic resistance. And most of your effort in cycling is on the flat goes into overcoming aerodynamic resistance. Reduce that and you go faster for the same effort. He realised by crouching down in a tuck, his arms were no longer part of the aerodynamic equation. He would go much faster for the same effort. Then he realised that he was too wide. He narrowed his bottom bracket, and he was able to do this because he could work metal and build his own frame. He built a frame that was much, much narrower in the bottom bracket than other bikes. By having a narrow bottom bracket means that your legs knock together and also knock against the top tube. So he took that out. He designed a bike which only had one tube going down. And his legs would rub together at the top of the pedal stroke, when the leg at the top of the pedal stroke would dip inwards. And it would look like he had a knock-kneed pedalling style. But really, he was turning his legs into one aerodynamic unit by putting them together. There would be no air going between them. And again, that made him faster. And in 100 years of bike design, no one had thought of this, and he thought of both of those things.
It was a kind of arms race, because Chris Boardman had this memorable Lotus bike, very aerodynamic, built by Mike Burrows and then improved by the Lotus car company. And so it did seem as though cycling was accelerating on the equipment front.
Boardman, after he won the Olympic Games, in a way, his bike was actually more famous than he was. I mean, people remembered the Lotus bike, and Boardman's special Lotus bike was one of the stories of the 1992 Olympics. Obrey as well. His bike was as much a part of the story as he was. He even got nicknamed Old Faithful. I think one of the French journalists, Pierre Ballester, invented that name for it. And the bikes were equally part of the story with the riders, whereas before it was always the riders who were the most important factor.
And what do you think about that? I mean, what's your take on the way in which Obrey's innovations were banned time after time by the governing body of cycling, the UCI? Do you think that was fair? Or do you think they were standing up for the sport as an athletic pursuit, that if it becomes too much about the machine, then, the athletic side of it is diminished?
It's a bit of everything, really. I mean, cycling has always been about the march of technology as well. Bikes have always improved, and research will always go into making bikes that are a little bit lighter or a little bit more aerodynamic than previously. The UCI did find themselves, you know, suddenly having to deal with this fast-moving situation where new positions were being invented, and I think they got frightened by that, and they were a little harsh in the way they dealt with it.
Was he persecuted, O'Bree, because his face didn't fit, because they just didn't like who he was?
But there's an element to that as well, because like I said before, the hour record had always been held by these greats of the sport, and the UCI is very protective of the sport as well, and you know the greats are the iconic names of cycling, and O'Bree's name didn't fit, his face didn't fit, and I think that yes, he was singled out, and it was a bit unfair. At the same time, there are interesting philosophical questions over what cycling is, because a recumbent bike goes much, much faster than a normal upright bike, but you're not allowed to use those in competition. No one has a problem with that. So you get into these quite tricky philosophical questions with, is the tuck position proper cycling or not? And they decided that it was too far away from the classic cycling shape of the body, and it was giving an unfair biomechanic advantage. So I can understand both points of view. I think O'Bree was an amazing innovator and so original with his thinking that we're privileged to have had him in the sport. At the same time, I can see that the UCI wanted to protect what cycling is philosophically and as you know, for the definition of cycling. So it's very
You're sitting on the fence.
I am sitting on the fence. It's a difficult one. I think that the Superman position that was subsequently banned, I think that was unfair because that was just a logical extension of the tri-bar position, whereas the tuck, you couldn't ride a bunched road race in the tuck position because it would be too dangerous. So I can see the point of view, but I'm glad I didn't have to make the decision. But at the same time, I do think, and I would stress that we were privileged to have Graham O'Bree in the sport. It was a lot richer for having him in it.
Just crossed over the bridge, walked across the field towards the stone spire of a church that you said, that looks pretty old.
12th century, apparently, as we learned.
Yeah, we just had a look around inside. It's built entirely of this very characteristic red sandstone of this part of Herefordshire. And there was a little interpretive board on one of the walls explaining how the bridge came into being. Apparently this church was here, obviously, and then I think the vicar lived across the other side of the Wye and would have to come across by boat, but would sometimes have difficulty getting across because the boatman wouldn't take him for one reason or another. And for some time, one of the vicars came across on stilts, across the river on stilts, and eventually, I think towards the end of the 19th century, they built that iron bridge to enable the vicar to get across to speak to his parishioners.
More practical than the stilts, that bridge, I feel.
You know, they have those stilts that the shepherds walk about on in the Landes region of southwest France, where it's very flat and sort of marshlands, and the shepherds used to get around on stilts there because I think it would enable them to cover more distance.
I guess you're right. Yeah, it's maybe it's a new commuting method that's yet to be mined. Someone can make a lot of money out of this.
Well, how about Graham O'Bree?
Sell stilts, more aerodynamic stilts.
It's his kind of thing, isn't it?
To commute as it is, yes. It's a different way of looking at how to get from A to B.
Rethink walking. O'Bree's innovations were largely to do with aerodynamics and the shape of the bicycle and his position on the bike. While Chris Boardman did have access to this Lotus bike for a certain number of the events that he did, including the Barcelona Olympics. His innovation was more sort of physiological, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. He was working with Peter Keane. Peter Keane was very advanced in his theories of working to different heart rates for different reasons, and Boardman was doing a lot less quantity of training, which set him apart at the time. He was riding very few hours a week, but he was using all those hours properly rather than just going out and hammering himself and making himself tired. This was seen as revolutionary. It wasn't popular, but boy, did it get results.
And how did that knowledge come about? How did Peter Keane or Chris or the pair of them, how did they figure out that this was the way to go? Or was it just trial and error?
Trial and error is, it might sound disparaging, but yes, that's how science progresses, a lot through trial and error and trying things, and if they work, great, if they don't, fine, but at least you know about it. And Keane is very much he's not just a scientist, he's kind of a philosopher of science as well. He's very interested in how we build knowledge, and he was building a body of knowledge, and he admits that at the time they didn't really know what they were doing, but they were trying all these things. He was a very advanced sports scientist, but they were trying out new things. It was new territory for cycling. No one had ever tried this before.
What were they trying to achieve by riding less, but riding in a more controlled way to particular heart rates?
I think they realised that rest was very important, and by training hard constantly over a period of days, weeks and months, you just wear yourself down. You get fitter at the start, then you hit a plateau and kind of bump along, and in a way it's trial and error whether you get good form or not. Whereas they realised that by resting, you know, you can rebuild your body and therefore do better the next training ride. And by working to different heart rates, they realised that by being specific about training, you could push the body much harder for a shorter period of time and make the adaptions that were necessary to ride faster and do it efficiently rather than through trial and error and luck.
And has that kind of training become the standard way of doing things now?
When you read about what Team Sky are doing with their riders and what Bradley Wiggins did last year with his trainer, Tim Kerrison, you know, there's a reason for everything they do. They do blocks of training, they do certain efforts, and it's all kind of boxes to be ticked, and it's all worked out well in advance, and they get feedback as well, but it's very, very highly designed, and you know, that's come from Chris Boardman. No one else was doing that at the time.
And was he doing that throughout his career?
Yeah, essentially. He met Peter Keane when he was, I think, still a teenager, 16, 17, when he met him and started working with him. And they worked together so well. Keane had already worked with Tony Doyle and Colin Sturgis, two other pursuiters in the 1980s, very successful, each won the World Championships. But he didn't quite click with them professionally, whereas Boardman was as much a part of the science of it as Keane. Keane had most of the ideas, but Boardman gave very, very clear feedback so that Keane was getting good results, whereas with other riders, Keane wasn't getting the clarity in the results he's getting back. So Boardman and Keane found each other at the perfect moment in each other's career.
And ultimately, it was Boardman and Keane that triumphed, if we are to look at the rivalry and say, well, who came out on top? Because Chris Boardman had a very successful professional career, winning Tour de France Prologue, wearing the yellow jersey, being a team leader of a major French team. You know, he did well, not a particularly long career, but he was a success, and he presumably made a fair bit of money.
Oh yeah, three yellow jerseys and a good career and a fair number of race wins. I heard a saying once that in a theoretical battle between ice and fire, ice wins every time, and Boardman's methods and results won out in the end. Although Aubrey was incredibly successful, he was a one-off. I described him in the book as, again, it's not meant to be disparaging, but it as an evolutionary dead end. He was such a one-off that he took himself as far as he could go, but it wasn't a foundation for someone else to continue on from. Whereas with Boardman's career was the template which Peter Keane applied to the whole of British cycling, which engendered the success that we've seen at subsequent Olympic Games. So all of the success we've seen now through Bradley Wiggins at the Tour de France, Chris Hoy and Bradley Wiggins at the Olympic Games, and all the other medals we've won, they've been essentially standing on Chris Boardman's shoulders. His legacy continues, whereas Aubrey's is a wonderful story, but self-contained.
So in telling your story of the rivalry between Chris Chris Boardman and Graham O'Bree, one thing that comes through is, as you said at the beginning of our conversation, the state of British cycling in those days, very much a kind of amateur sport where there wasn't a lot of money involved. It was all about hard graft, ultimately. Very much a contrast to the world across the channel of professional road racing, which is a big money world with lots of associated issues in relation to doping. And this juxtaposition of the purity of the British time trialists and the cheating road racers across the channel. Obviously, that's a exaggerated characterisation. But to readers of the book, it will come as a surprise that you do raise a question in relation to a particular performance of Chris Boardman in 1996,
yeah.
When he set a new hour record at 56 kilometres, which is a quantum leap beyond the distances that he and O'Bree had been recording in the peak of their hour record rivalry, and was an extraordinary record. And you raise a question about that.
Sure, yeah. I think it's a blessing and a curse for cycling fans that we question performance because of the nature of what's happened in the sport in the last 20 years. As doping was rife in professional road racing. And so virtually every performance from the early 90s onwards on the road is rightly called into question. We've discovered some things. I think we've only just lifted the carpet to see the murk beneath. But we know that a lot of performances were based on cheating. You know, Tour de France wins, for example, classics wins. A lot of people have confessed to this, so this is a matter of record. So we have to look at all performances in that context. It's right to be not cynical but sceptical about sporting performance, because sporting performance must be achieved fairly or it has no meaning at all. So in 93, when Boardman and O'Bree set the record in close proximity to each other, they were riding long 51. Boardman got just over, did 52 and a quarter kilometres an hour, and then O'Bree set it the next year, just raised it, budged it up towards 53 kilometres. So 52, 53 kilometres was the absolute limit of athletic performance at the time. Suddenly, in 1995, I believe, Tony Rominger, who'd never really ridden on the track before, he was a late developer as a cyclist, which you can ask how that happened. That's a separate issue. But he suddenly came out and rode 55 kilometres after not ever having been on a track. And riding a track's quite an acquired skill. You need to... It's not just a question of poking your handlebars in a straight line ride. There are certain pacing strategies and methods of riding, whether you're on the corner or the straight, which affect your speed. And Rominger came out of nowhere and rode 55 kilometres, two kilometres further than Boardman and O'Bree. And then the next year, Boardman rode 56 kilometres. So we have to analyse those performances. Tony Rominger was a client of Dr. Ferrari, who was banned from working in cycling, and one of the notorious doping doctors, who also worked with Lance Armstrong. Now, Boardman's reputation was that he was clean, but we can't just listen to riders saying they're clean, because Lance Armstrong said he was clean all those years. It took 15 years of denial before he said, oh, actually, oh, it wasn't so clean after all. So we have to look at these things, and we can't be exact about it, because I don't have the exact figures. So every time you make an estimation, you blur the edges and the boundaries of what you know to be true. So looking at the aerodynamics of Chris Boardman in that Superman position, and the biomechanical efficiency that he had, and his VO2 max, which is a measure of how much oxygen your body can process, and his power in terms of watts, it's clear that that 56-kilometre record is right on the very, very outside of human achievement. And the conclusion to be made is either it's the best clean performance that's ever been done, and that is possible, or there is an alternative. But I wasn't there, and I cannot say for certain what happened. And if it's the greatest clean performance ever, then that's fantastic, because it's a great thing for sport. If it's not, I'm not the one to say how it happened or why it happened. It's only a few people would know that.
And did you put the question to Chris Boardman?
I put the question to Peter Keane, who had the information about Chris Boardman. He maintains that Chris Boardman did come out of the 1996 Tour de France. Very, very hard experience for him. He suffered his way around France. It was a terrible race for him, but he really brutalised himself in that tour and then started to come up towards the end, according to Keane, and then enjoyed in the weeks following the Tour de France an unprecedented purple patch of absolutely bomb-proof form, and came third in the time trial at the Atlanta Olympic Games. His form was rising, he could feel himself getting better and better, and then rode the World Pursuit Championship, broke the world record, rode a 4:12 individual pursuit, which is again a very, very strong performance, which that record wasn't beaten until last year. And then broke the hour record on the back of that, rode 56 kilometres in a position that's subsequently been banned because it was deemed unacceptable by the UCI. It's actually Graham Obrey's invention, the Superman position. So all these factors, according to Keane, were what contributed towards this unprecedented achievement in the hour. But because of the bans on the position, amongst other things, I believe we won't see another ride like that ever again.
And will we see a contest like Graham Obrey and Chris Boardman ever again? One interesting, I think it's probably the purplest piece of prose in the book, where you talk about how media managers and PR people have wrung the character out of cyclists, and you're left with a thin gruel, I think is the expression that you use.
A beige gruel.
A beige gruel. You know, you want some meat and thick, rich liquor to get your teeth into as a journalist. Do you feel that cycling has become a robotic sport, where you can't get close enough to the riders, and they are part of bigger organisations, and you just can't tell a story like this story? Or do you think there will be other stories like this story?
I hope there are. I do think that media management has a chilling effect on interest and emotional engagement in sport. I think the primary reason for many people to be interested in sport, and certainly my primary reason, is emotional engagement. And for emotional engagement, you have to have access to the characters, the personalities, the individuals involved. And I feel that that's starting to build a bit of distance between the athletes and the fans and the public, which you create that distance, then you create a barrier between them. And the cycling has always historically been a sport where you can get close enough to touch your idols. There's no other sport where you can get so close, and that empathy and close link between the public and the protagonist is what's made cycling so unique. So I do think we've lost something in this age of media management and PR. I think it would be great if another story like this did come along. I think the hour record is on, it seems to have become a bit of a museum piece because of the rule changes, and you can't even ride tri-bars anymore. You have to ride in the Merckx position. Nobody wants to do that. To do the training and get used to riding in an hour in that fixed position on the handlebars, it takes too much time out of a schedule for too great a risk. So it's kind of on ice at the moment. I think if the UCI did allow a tri-bar position, not Superman, but the tri-bar position, like they do in the pursuit on the track and in time trials, you'd see more interest because that record's ripe for breaking. You could get Bradley Wiggins could go head-to-head against Fabian Cancellara, two of the finest time trialists ever to have ridden, both at their just enjoying their peak now, and they're being denied a chance to compare themselves with the greatest of the sport. I think that would be a fantastic story. I mean, you know, the Swiss metronome against the up-and-down, you know, Brit, the Londoner. I think that would be a great story.
I was riding with Edward Pickering, and his book, The Race Against Time, Obrey, Boardman, and the Quest to Be the Fastest Man on Two Wheels, is out now. It's published by Bantam Press, and it's a jolly good read. Since I recorded that interview, Fabian Cancellara has announced that he is planning to make an attempt on the hour record, although he hasn't nominated a time and a place. And all we're waiting for is Brad Wiggins to throw his hat into the ring. He's had a pretty dire 2013 after his amazing year last year. Perhaps an attempt on the hour record is a good way to get himself back on track. And of course, Graham Obrey is set to make his attempt on the world record for human-powered vehicles out in the Nevada desert, riding an extraordinary machine called the Beastie, which he has invented and built. He's attempting to travel at more than 80 miles an hour. An extraordinary bike and an extraordinary man. We'll keep our fingers crossed for that. That's all for The Bike Show this week. Thanks for listening. And if you're out riding Lost Lanes, Do send in your photos via Twitter or Facebook or Pinterest with the tag Lost Lanes to be in with a chance to win a lovely art print, limited edition by Andrew Pavitt of the Lost Lanes book cover illustration. Until next week, goodbye.